How's it going, everybody? So today's podcast was one of my favorites of the year so far. I wanted to do a quick intro before we bring Darren in. He has quite the track record, everything from music to software companies, things that he started up. And the three main points we really hit on here is we go deep into leadership. We talk about the struggles, what it takes, and the simple but difficult concepts. We do hit on AI and what and how to utilize it and how to not where you should be looking at and some of the things that I think others aren't really talking about, which was great. And then we go into really what makes not only a great entrepreneur, but what made it that he was successful when so many others fail, especially in the first, in that startup, and really getting it off the ground. I found the conversation fascinating, timely, and I believe it's something that all of you will enjoy. So, thanks. Darren, what's going on? Welcome to the podcast, man.
Thanks for having me.
We see a lot of people that either want to come on or they send over information or we're reaching out to try to get people on. And you have a very interesting past, and what you're doing today, I think, is really relevant to a lot of discussions that are going on and the change within the overall environment. So I have a few things that I want to dive into to ask you, but let's get a baseline here so we can understand kind of your experience and what you've created and what you're doing. So why don't you give the audience a real quick background into how you got to where you are now? And then from there, I want to hit on some of these really interesting topics.
Awesome. Okay, I'll try to keep this quick. It's been a bit of an odd journey, but you know, did what a lot of people do when they graduate from high school is I went to university because that's what you're supposed to do, and did pre-engineering in my first year and didn't like the labs. Started to introduced to alcohol and freedom from my parents and girls and like living and. That became really, I did really well in those courses, but just didn't really have a purpose, right, for why I was there. I was doing it because I was, what I was expected to do, but I didn't have an objective. And transferred over to business, similarly, didn't really have an objective. And then I left university, went on an exchange program, lived in Hungary for a year, really awesome experience. I mean, I grew up in a really small town of like less than 1,000 people, with the closest city nearby being about 30,000 people. The closest real city to that's probably about a 4-hour drive. So I grew up in a pretty remote place. My mom owned a dance school. So I grew up in a very artistic, like dance, music, performance type environment my whole life. So then after I came back from this exchange program, I was all about like, I know what I want to do. I want to be a rock star. So I was like, I'm not going back to school. I'm going to start a band. I started a band, played music, toured, did that whole thing for a while. Ended up really realizing that what I liked the most about music was being in the studio. So I became an audio engineer and producer, worked on a bunch of my own material, worked on material for other people, ended up starting a record label in 2005. We were an EMI distributed label, signed 4 bands, put out 7 or 8 records during that time. The economic crash 2007, 2008, the music industry was already in trouble. Decided to make my first SaaS company because I was using a lot of web-based software at that time, which, 2005, not a whole lot. A lot of businesses didn't even know what the cloud was. Yeah. I don't even know if we had coined that term yet. But so built a SaaS company, started in 2008. I went with the industry that I knew, which I'd worked in by this point about 10 years of my life, the music industry, events, live performance, that kind of thing. And so built a platform for music festivals and events. We started off with local Canadian small festivals. By 2014, we were the back end for Coachella and Bonnaroo and Burning Man and all these big events. We also had sporting events like X Games and so on. So that introduced me to cybersecurity, because at this point now I had a company. We were a SaaS company. We were categorized as critical infrastructure for most of these events as we started working with the more corporate events that had third-party due diligence and cybersecurity programs. They started really scrutinizing our security because the growing scope of what our platform was doing in their business. Of course, our cybersecurity was pretty lacking at that time. We weren't cybersecurity folks. We were a couple of music guys that decided to build a SaaS company, thought it was cool. And so, you know, we really had to go through a lot of learning and a lot of growing. We had to make a lot of big improvements to our company and our platform to meet those requirements. We did that. Actually decided I really liked security and thought there was just such a need for creativity and a different approach than what I had seen historically. And you know, after coming out of the struggles and pains we had of figuring out how we're going to implement enterprise security in our pretty small tech startup, it just opened my eyes to a big opportunity. So I started going down the path of studying that, learning more about it. And that's really what led me to building Carbide, which we started in 2017, but really doubled down in 2018 when I sold my last company. And so fast forward now, we're sitting here, it's 2024, and yeah, we've got a company, we've got something around 260 companies that work, use our platform, and we also have a service component. Basically, what we do is we partner with companies to really help them understand what it is that they should be doing based on the types of data they're storing or processing or the types of customers they're working with. We help them actually build their entire security and data privacy program, and then we incorporate auditing and different checkpoints into that so they can hold themselves accountable. And of course, all of the presentations, dashboards, trust centers, things like that, that they would need to share with their stakeholders and their customers to demonstrate that they're actually, you know, safe, trustworthy entity, and they have the skills and the toolage to properly look after customer data.
Yeah, music to cybersecurity. That's a way to get there, I guess.
weird. It's not the traditional way, as I've learned. It's not the traditional way. It's funny. I actually talked to somebody the other day who was another musician that I know that's in cybersecurity. They're working for Deloitte doing risk stuff, right? And you know, we got to talk, and it was interesting, fascinating conversation. We both saw this from the onset when we got into security. It's like it's typically people that have this technical or networking or some sort of technical background that historically have got into cybersecurity. Yet when you go in and you look at dysfunctional cybersecurity programs that have technical skills, what you realize is that what they're not lacking in the technical skills, they're lacking in the ability to create a narrative and tell a story and get people on board, to go to the board, to get budget, to be able to speak in business terms. So yeah. There's a lacking of, when you take this very technical route, there's a whole value proposition. There's a lot of requirements technically in cybersecurity, but there's also this other component that I think lacks heavily in cybersecurity, which is the ability to talk about it in a less technical way, in yes. a more business way, and the skills required to sell. So your cybersecurity guy comes in and goes, you need to do this, 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 and people go, oh, change, right? And if yeah. you're not able to really get people, like apply this concept of leadership and presentation and be able to get people on board and navigate a project and navigate people through the process of a change, then you end up with the them, us, and them, where cybersecurity guys and gals are in there like they don't earn the respect. There's sort of this, they don't like each other, and the organization gets stuck with what you would think are the simple things like getting people to change their habits, which are actually way harder than going in and fixing the full network infrastructure most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. This, it's such an interesting aspect that I think a lot of people in any kind of leadership, right, but especially entrepreneurship, where they may be really good at the thing, and they may have a really good vision, and they have a really hard time articulating it and transferring the ability to not them just doing. So like a lot of entrepreneurs get started because they're good at the thing, right? Oh, I'm a good attorney. I'm going to make my own attorney firm, or I'm a good specialist. And so that means I should have my own company and run it. I'm good at making this thing. I'm good at investing. I'm good at doing this thing. So I build a company around it. And then it gets built around just them, and mm-hmm. they can't pass on, and they can't articulate the vision, what needs to be done, and how to put the puzzle pieces together. And I view it as they make themselves a trap that they like can't get out of. And communication is one of the largest parts of this. And this is something, by the way, that everybody struggles with. Like, I think a lot of people look at me and they're like, oh, you're a great communicator. And I'm like, it's different, but communication it's really hard. And to be able to communicate in a way that brings a lot of people together and even gets after a singular mission, I struggle with that. I, in, because 100%. It's really, it can be really, really hard.
It's one of these. I was listening to a book recently. It's called. I just started reading it. The Troubled CEO, I think it's called. But there was an interesting quote in it. It talks about like how leadership is very simple, but not easy. So It's like the concepts when they're explained to you, it's like, duh. This is not like, you know, you're not crushing
rocket science.
You're not smashing atoms here, right? Nope. Like it's pretty basic stuff, but to actually do it and incorporate it into your practice is such a discipline. I totally get it. And, you know, I even find like for us when COVID happened, we were before COVID, 11 of us all working out of a single office. And communication just more natural, right? You're having meetings together, you're communicating. I found that the transition to go to remote was actually difficult. I found that, you know, I kept finding people in silos and like the natural things that were just happening just by being together were not. And then you started to have to figure out and craft ways to be much more deliberate and planned with your communication.
I could not agree more. And one of the biggest things that I thought of looking at it, the bigger companies, I think, actually had an easier time doing it because their employees were pure specialists.
Yeah.
So it's like, no, you only do this one thing. We don't want you to make decisions. We don't want you to be involved in what he's doing. You only do this. You report to this one person.
Move your cog.
Do it right. Move your cog. Small, mid-sized companies, we don't act like that. It's like,
it's not even just that. It's the lack of documented process and documentation around what's going on. So when you're a small company, you don't have that. And this is so funny because this is part of the challenge that we struggle with when we go in and take, like, say, a small 25, 30, 40 person company and try to get them ready to go do a SOC 2 audit or something like that. Part of a SOC 2 audit, it's not just cybersecurity, it's organizational operational hygiene of like policies and procedures and KPIs and reporting metrics and structure. And that, like a lot of organizations that size, we don't necessarily have that very much. And I think that's what really was also hard. So you've got specialization, as you brought up, but then you also have this lack of clarity, documented clarity on who does what and what are we doing with this? And people are all out there. They, you know, you give them, they all have the high level where we're trying to go, but everybody has their own interpretation. We struggle with it. And we at one point tried to, we doubled the size of our team while being remote. And it did not double the effectiveness and the outcomes. It doubled our burn, but did not affect the top line to the way that, you know, really a real humbling experience for me.
I went through that too, and it was very humbling.
I was learning where you're like, I thought I was a great leader, and what I realize is I'm a good leader that has a whole lot of opportunity to be more effective and more deliberate in my practice. And it actually led me down the path of a lot of reading over the last 2 years and even going and taking some cutting edge courses just to like sharpen this goddamn sword. Again, these things are simple concepts, but the practice
is not simple at all. It is very difficult. And I, you know, because what you're talking about is something, and I've been talking about it a lot. So it's funny even too that you bring it up, because I'm like, this has been on the forefront of my mind. And one of the biggest misconceptions, I think, that like as an entrepreneur, and when you have a business, you have to change to the needs of the business. So a lot of people think that people should change around them. And it's like, no, I don't need to change. I'm great how I am. And you're like, that is just, to me, I'm like, that is such a horrible attitude, because the business needs different things from a leader at different times. And if you can't change and be a different type of leader, you need to leave, because you're hurting the people that need you to be someone different. They need you to be a different type of leader, right? And I view it as, I had this concept of degrees of separation. Like, so when you start out, there's 0 degrees of separation from you and the customer, right? It's like, nope, I'm here. It's just me and working.
You are the business.
You are the business. There's nothing else.
Your marketing, your product.
Everything. And then you get your first employee that interfaces with the customer. Now there's 1 degree of separation. Then you get management. Now there's 2 degrees of separation. And then when you get a leadership team, there's 3 degrees of separation because now you have leadership, management, employee, then the customer. Yeah. And the leader, the reason I think about it like this is because it has not, it doesn't really have anything to do except for the person that you need to become. So you, 1 degree of separation, working and interfacing directly with an employee is very simple. This is how I do it. You do it. You have any questions, just ask me, right? That's a different kind of leader than if you have management. Now you have to build processes and systems that the management can hold that employee accountable to in there.
Yeah.
You have to be a different kind of leader to do this. Yeah. Now you're dealing with managers, right? And then when you get like a C-suite, now you're with creators. So now you're leading people that need to create and grow the company, and you don't have even a say in it. So who you have to become, that is so difficult to, first of all, be humble enough to say, I need to be more, and these people need me to be more. They need a different type of leader. And then even harder to actively go about changing your habits as a leader, your communication styles, yep. right? I think
letting go of things.
Letting right? go. That I have a hard time with that. I really do. That's hard for me to just let go of things, processes, things that have worked and people yeah. that have helped and worked to be able to move on. It's something that, like you said, we say it sounds simple, but it is not talked about enough and how difficult that is for the growth of a leader to grow to be the type of leader they need to be. It is very, very difficult. Most entrepreneurs can never do it, and that's why yeah. they hire in professional CEOs and managers because they can't yep. do it. They cannot change to be who the company needs, so they have to get out of the way.
And then or they either get out of the way or they're just so damn fatigued by the time it gets to that scale because it's not scalable for the individual
yeah.
to not let go and have that much going on in the business. So then you burn yourself out to the yep. point where you're pushed out maybe, depending
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, I mean.
We've all felt that. I think that's something it gets to a point for most of us. I know it did for me as well as others. Like, I'm going to die. Like. Yeah. This is going to happen to it. The company is not going to work or I'm going to die. So how do I this has to fundamentally change. Yeah. And, that's hard. That's really hard.
Yeah. And it's like hard. It's hard to let go, but then letting go correctly is also hard. Cause hard. As you said, you have to make sure you've taken the time to articulate with absolute clarity what the goals and objectives are. You have to take time to document things. You have to have some degree of processes and procedures built into the business and KPIs and accountability. You bring in those people too quickly and you let go too quickly, then especially in a remote environment, and this is sort of the experience we had once I finally got good at letting go, realized that I didn't do a great job at that transition and creating that clarity. I probably should have waited a few months and spent some time really getting clarity on what we're doing and documenting a little more before taking such a leap back and having department heads come in and take over those departments. So
it's because being reactionary was the mode of operations as you're smaller.
Yeah.
And that's really yeah. important. Like when you're small, you need to be able to move quick, make quick decisions.
You need to be agile. The business needs to be agile. Not just you, the whole business needs to be agile.
And as your company grows, that's actually opposite of true. It shouldn't be agile like that because people get whiplash. They don't know yeah. what's happening. They don't know what's going on. They don't know why there's so much change. So yeah. it
freaks them out.
Freaks them out. And then you lose good people. And yeah. I love this conversation just because it is so important. And you see, we have investing a lot. Like I'm like, the investment didn't fail. The structure failed. Like what they did on it failed. And I think a huge percentage of the time for companies that are successful, the company doesn't fail, the leadership fails. Yeah. And that's a real sad spot to be in, right? And something that
yeah.
we see and I hope we, I don't get in. So talk to me about how your company, how you built it out today and how are you operating a company. Talk to me about that transition for you and what it felt like yeah. and going through and how you processed and did that in a growing company.
So we moved pretty quickly from being 11 or 12 people to being 30 some people. all spread out across the country. We brought in a lot of experienced people that came from bigger companies. It didn't go super well, to be honest. Like it was, you know, I think we tried to move as fast as we could, which was faster than we've ever moved before, which was sloppy and messy. And we ended up, like I said, I kind of alluded to it earlier, we ended up, you know, really increasing our burn while not necessarily increasing the business's growth to the extent that we were hoping. And so we actually reeled it back a little bit about probably over the last 6 months, we've reeled it back. So I'm actually more in touch with the business now than I was a year ago in terms of like, I talk to customers again.
Yeah.
And I think the lesson that I've learned there is I actually let go too fast. Like I actually got out of that seat and tried to do too much too fast.
I did the same thing. I did the same thing. It was just like, okay, I need to do this. I'm going to jump over and do that.
Yep.
And that separation caused huge issues. And two, I think that I also did, I was so far away from the point of touch and creation that it's really hard to build out a team and everything when you lose sight, you're away from it. So you miss things.
Yeah, 100%. And so now I feel better about the business now than I have in a really long time. And I'm much closer to customers, and I've spent a lot of time with the employees too, and hearing there's people out there that have a lot of good insight that might not feel comfortable voicing that, especially as you build more structure in your business.
Yes.
And so, you know, a lot of great insights talking to the team, talking to the customers, and it's actually led quite a transformation in terms of how we deliver our products and services to the customer. And we've seen just in the last quarter a dramatic improvement in customer satisfaction. And so now it's like, okay, now I'm in the trenches. I'm hearing what the customers are talking about, and the dynamics of the environment of the economy and especially what we're doing are changing so quickly that if your perspective is from talking to customers 12 months ago, you're missing stuff. Yep. You're in the land of the obsolete, right? So I vouch to it now as I start to scale back up and we're starting to bring some more people into the team to still keep a certain threshold, a certain baseline of communication at that level as a core value for me as a leader, because it's critical. And so, you know, now that we've made this massive transition in terms of how we deliver to the customer, we're seeing customer satisfaction just go up, like go through the roof. And we're in an industry where there's a bit of a race to the bottom, where it's a price war. There's a lot of people that have invested a lot of money into this sort of market. There's probably 50 or 60 companies that offer some sort of platform that's in some way, shape, or form, you know, providing value in the same context that our platform does. We've differentiated our way, and we're seeing our average deal value go up while the market trend is going down. So really focusing on not being the best for everybody, but figuring out what can we be awesome at that we can be really specialized, right? And for us, it's been customer intimacy. And how do we build our product? How do we innovate process? How do we bring in the right people to have that value proposition of customer intimacy and build strong relationship, strong retention in our customers? And now we're taking that, now moving it through. My co-founder is much more closer to the sales operation, talking to the customers on that level. So now it's, okay, let's dial in how we tell the story. Let's make this secret sauce that's obviously showing the results in customer satisfaction. Let's take that over to our positioning and our value proposition and our differentiation and take that out to market and use that to grow. So it's growing faster is so easy to spend money. And you get in this situation, and this is certainly how we felt in our situation. You bring on investors and they see other players drop, and they see the Sequoias of the world dropping in big checks into other players. And you get this, all of a sudden this pressure comes about where it's the sentiment of like, you need to run faster, 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 even if you can't. Well, if you can't, what are you going to do? You're going to fall flat in your face, right? Yep. So, you know, taking a step back, take a breath of air and figuring out strategically what are going to be the challenges, and a great learning experience, right? Like my last business grew 30% year over year, and we never ever tried really to do this. So I never had that experience, but great humbling experience. And it just makes me want to grow again. Cause now I'm sure I'll mess something else up, but I learned a lot in just seeing the seeing what worked and what didn't work when we tried to scale, especially like say as a remote company. So pretty fascinating journey. And now we're documenting the hell out of everything. Like we're really
everything.
Like everything, right? Really clear. And of course, you know, you can use AI tools to help you do that. And really creating greater clarity and communicating to the point almost where it feels redundant. But I think in a, as a remote culture, if it doesn't feel redundant, you're probably not saying those core messaging points enough.
Well, what you're talking about is the perfect example of a third degree leader, because it's what you need to do. You're bringing everybody together. You're no longer doing necessarily the things, but you can't do that if you don't understand your business. So it's like you have to bring it all from top to bottom, and it's actually from opposite bottom to top together. And what you experienced, I experienced too. I got so far away from the end of my product, I didn't understand what was happening on the product. And then I was trying to build out things to get results, and I wasn't understanding how those results were being transferred. So once I got to a third degree leader, my problem was that I wasn't on the bottom. So I had to start going to my sites. I had to start going in. And it was like, I'm talking to the individuals on the bottom, right? Because I wasn't doing the thing anymore, I had to understand so you can lead everyone and bring everyone together. And it's about that communication. Because if people feel like you don't understand or you don't get it, they're not going to follow you.
Nope.
Oh, that's, I love 100%. That. I want to switch from a leadership topic, because you kind of mentioned, to AI. You do cybersecurity, and one of the things that we're looking at right now is the involvement of AI. And I know this feels like a mad rush. Everybody's rushing to AI. I feel like no one really understands it and because it just changes so quick, and there's so many products and services and everything out, and it's like, do you need everything? Should you have everything? And what should we be implementing in our business so we don't fail? This does come with some risks, and I don't think anybody's, I haven't heard anybody talking about the risks except for Terminator. So what do you see in this AI landscape, especially for businesses and on a cybersecurity side, integrating just AI in every single way, shape or form? Somebody finds a great AI tool and a whole department's now running off of it. And, you know, it's so fast. I think entrepreneurs, leaders, they don't really have a grasp of even what's being used within their own company at this point.
I spend a lot of time in my personal life playing with AI tools. I have probably now for almost 2 years. Mm-hmm. And great way to, you know, the more you write prompts in ChatGPT, the better you start understanding the capacities and capabilities. So I think if you're running a business, if you're the leader of a business, and I mean, I can't even imagine what kind of business can't benefit from AI. It's so,
yeah, I can't either.
It's so wide, right, in terms of what it can do, and capacities are increasing at such a velocity that, yeah, I think when I talk to somebody and I say, like, and I talked to a person who was running, I was doing some contracting work as a writer, like doing like online posts and blog posts and newsletters and stuff. And I was like, oh, you're using AI? No, I'm a writer, blah, blah, blah. I was like, well, you probably won't be a writer for long.
Exactly. Yep.
If you know, the best thing you can do right now is start learning how to write prompts and learning how to be really effective with that tool so that you can, and of course now that person doesn't have a job anymore because they've been replaced by AI. Mm-hmm. And you know, similar conversation I had with a lawyer. I was like, well, you know, what's your thoughts? Oh, well, you know, you're going to still need lawyers. I was like, okay, well, nobody said you're not going to need lawyers, but if you don't learn AI and learn to adopt the efficiencies and the value propositions of AI in the context, you are going to get steamrolled by this.
Yes.
The people that adopt it and start using it are going to have a higher likelihood of having a gain because of it. Now, just moving over to, so I think we can all align on like, wow, this is great. It can be used in a lot of great ways. Yeah, the risks. So I guess when I think about risks for AI, I think about privacy as a big concern. So, you know, what data are you sharing in there? And how well do you understand what's being shared with the LLM? What's the security and privacy policy of that LLM, the large language model that you're using? Are you unnecessarily sharing PII? So there's a lot of thoughts around data privacy and where that data is going to go. It's not an easy topic, though. It's complicated, right?
Complicated.
So, you know, and this is why, like in this last year, like I've taken quite a few courses around system engineering and AI and stuff, just trying to understand architecturally what's going on, more adopting better practices. There's also laws coming out, right? So Europe has launched a law around the use of AI. There's laws happening. There's laws in different stages happening in the U.S. and in Canada. And so you start getting into things around the ethics of AI and, you know, what decisions AI is allowed to make and what human intervention is required. So there's all kinds of biases in AI that could be based on race, color, sex, marital status, whatever, right? Because there's all kinds of scenarios where AI can actually be problematic, and it can make decisions that would be biased or not ethical. And so now you have to start thinking about AI governance in your business, because that's really quickly coming to the table. So in other words, understanding policies around how AI is adopted, what is allowed to be used, what's the process for vetting. Are you doing a risk assessment and a privacy impact assessment when you're adopting a new AI tool or building an AI tool or bringing in a new proceduralized use case of AI in your business? Are you sure that you're complying with the data privacy requirements? Are you sure that you're complying with any other ethical obligations that you may have? And then around security, well, there's so much there, right? It's moving so quickly. There's different ways. Like, we have several different AI components that we use in our tool. We have one very simple AI, which is basically like rule-based system type AI that sits in our own environment that's highly secure. We have another tool that we have in our own isolated server environment, so it's not being shared with another company per se. Like, we're taking an open source AI tool, it's isolated in an environment. And then we have other cases where we're using, you know, something more sophisticated for some of the more elegant writing capacities of something like GPT-4, GPT-4 Turbo or something like that. But I mean, you really need to spend the time understanding. And I think, like, there's a lot of demand growing right now for people that understand AI, not just from a use case, but also from how do you manage risk? How do you manage the landscape? Because to your point, it's correct. And I've seen it even in my own company. Like, marketing is like, hey, we want to use this AI tool. And you go look at it. It's like, oh my God, like, guys, this is a lot of data is being dumped into this. Like, you know, we need to understand, like, what, we don't even know what LLM they're using. Like, yep. Where are they storing this data? What, who has access to it? You know, is there any limitation being provided to this data, to the people that are providing us the PII? Do they know that it's being used here? Like, this is violation upon violation if we use this in this way.
Well, and then the output. I think everybody was shocked by Google's AI when all of a sudden everything that was coming out of it was, people were like, what in the world is this? Like, I think, you know, it was trending obviously for a while on how, like, you know, you couldn't even get Google's AI to almost prompt a white person. Like, it was shocking. And people were like, this is one of the largest language models on earth. And it was so wildly, not only inaccurate, but biased that how do you even know then if you're a business owner and whatever data information, like, where is it coming from? So you're dependent now on something giving you answers or giving you something that you have no idea, in the employees and everybody, that language model that's being utilized, where does that come from? And it's almost,
and it's
like,
wrong sometimes. It's wrong. It's also like wrong on pure black and white factual matters.
Just
binary yes, no answers.
Wrong. Yeah.
It's completely wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are techniques you can use, you know, when you're using your, say, like an OpenAI API, and you're structuring how there's technical techniques that can be used that reduce its creativity while increasing its accuracy.
Yes.
And, you know, so I'll give you an example. Like, we have a tool now that provides very explicit security recommendations using AI. This is high risk. If this tool is wrong, that's a problem. So, you know, in our process and our procedure, everything that our AI tool does has to be reviewed and signed off by one of our internal security advisors, because we can't trust it 100%, and it's critical information that's being created by the LLM and shipped to the customer. Now, we have done quite a bit on our side to structure the data set of which, so instead of letting it just use its massive data, you can have an LLM use your own procedures and recommendations and knowledge base and confine it to where it can go for answers.
And we so love that.
Yeah. So then it'll say, I don't know, versus if you go to ChatGPT and type in the same thing, it won't say, I don't know most of the time.
Won't.
It'll come up with an answer and it may be
wrong.
Maybe right, maybe wrong. I actually did a test there. I paid for a Transport Canada professional drone exam. And I was planning to do I did the exam myself after studying, but then I was like, you know what? I'm going to pay for this exam again, and I'm going to do the exam, and I'm going to get ChatGPT to answer all the questions. And it failed the exam.
Yeah. I completely believe it. I've typed in, hey, ChatGPT, tell me about AJ Osborne, the self-storage investor. And it comes out with this huge thing all about me and stuff like that. And I was like wild. It was wild at the things that it got wrong. It wasn't that it got it wrong. It's like it made stuff up.
Mm.
And I was like, because first of all, 90% of it was correct. But the 10% that it got wrong was, I think, even like personal stuff, like about my family, things like that. And it was just, it's like it made it up. I'm like, I don't even know where this came from. And that was really interesting to see how the language model filled in gaps. And instead of not having gaps, it created something to fill it in. Whether that was even correct, I don't even know where it got some of the things from, because I'm like, I've never even heard of this. I don't have a kid that I don't, you know what I mean? So it's like, it just got confused, or I don't know.
And but it filled it in. The art of prompt engineering, and I kind of call it an art because it's as much art or more art than it is science, in my opinion. But I could ask it that same question with a more thoughtful prompt, and it would not have filled in, and it would have.
Yes.
So, and that's kind of the testing process that we go through when we beta tools, and we beta them internally. We put them through different scales, and we put them through different tests, and we create confines. And like, so in terms of how the tool reacts, to reduce its hallucination capacity or likelihood. Right.
So do you work with that then with your employees? Like, here's how we use prompts. Here's how we do it, and kind of like standardize that. Like, if you're going to use it, use prompts in this way. Do not use prompts in this way.
I do quite a bit of training around prompt engineering with my team, but also we build functions. So we have a chatbot in our tool that is really great because it allows us to test anything you think would be awesome if this tool did it. But once we get something going that it's great, we actually categorize, keep a log of all the prompts. And then myself and one of our other prompt engineers will go through and craft that prompt into a function. So we notice, okay, here's a thing we do. I'll give you an example. A prompt where we might say, like, here's a security addendum that one of our customers got from Netflix. Okay. They're going to sell their product to Netflix, and they want to do an analysis on that security addendum to see if there's anything being required in this document that isn't currently existing in their organizational controls and policies. And so it'll go through and do that analysis. That analysis by a human would take a long time, right? It could take like an hour and a half, 2 hours. But like, so that's something we see the customer wanting to use it for often. We structure a prompt, we build that into a function. So now you don't have to prompt it. You just have this tablet now where you like upload your security addendum here. It takes the security addendum. It packages the prompt behind the scene in our software. That's our proprietary prompt that we've crafted and engineered. Uses the LLM to do the work, abstracts the PII and identifiable information out of the data in the first place, brings all that back, restructures it, and presents it. We still have humans check it now because it's a reasonably new, but the accuracy now is above 99%.
Well, I love that. The other thing that I want to touch on too that you mentioned a little earlier is the inputs. So like crafting your own inputs into, so the language model, you know what's being derived from it. So one of the things we've looked at, like even with like our attorneys, things like that, is taking all of their information, their content, everything about like our contracts, right? All that, dumping it in so that staff and people could use a language model, but we know exactly where it's driving from. So they can say, hey, tell me about this deal or this structure and what it could be used. And then it works with them. So we don't obviously have to pay for an attorney to do that work or whatnot, but it's not open. It's not like, it's very defined. And that we're looking at as well as in the educational space and some things like that. The problem is you got to have a lot of it, but still it's at least we know as a company, like if the inputs, we know what the inputs are. So we know what the outputs are limited to.
Yeah. It's a ton of work get the AI tools to work really well. And actually, I'll make a great analogy because I think it aligns really well. It comes back to what we were talking about before when we were talking about leadership and communication. When you're lazy with your prompt, you create the garbage in, garbage out. So you go to chat, just even just say ChatGPT, you just put a lazy prompt in like, hey, tell me everything about Darren Gallup. For me to expect that it comes back with a good result is the same as me going into my team meeting or, you know, hiring a new executive and going, okay, just make this goddamn software work. It's like, okay, they're going to go try to figure that out, and who knows what hell they're going to come up with, right? Yeah. Versus the time, I find like when I'm doing prompt stuff, I find after about an hour, I start getting crappy results because I get tired of the amount of energy it takes, because it's really the art of explaining very well what you want or what you don't want, defining what the outcome should be.
Yes.
It's your brain has to work to define those requirements really well. And that is really the prompt. It's not really much different than sitting down with somebody, putting a lot of thought into explaining to them the job they're about to do. If you put more energy into how you explain that, you're more articulate and concise, and you structure that and communicate it better, that human is going to have a much higher degree of possibility or likelihood to perform the task you asked it. The LLM is not that much different.
That's awesome. So I don't want to take your whole day here, even though I have just all these questions that I could just keep going on. You've done some pretty awesome things. I want to talk about real quickly here as we wrap up your first startup that you did. I want to know what you thought made it successful from starting, not later on down the road and, oh, we got this deal, anything else like that. Why didn't it burn out in 6 months? Why didn't it burn out in a year? Why didn't it fall to the wayside? What made it be able to actually, like, what did you do at the start to make it work?
I think ultimately we were just so passionate about the problem we were solving that we legitimately, we came from the problem space and we were just so excited. We were so committed. And I think us, honestly, like the naivety of how hard of a journey it was going to be was actually an attribute. It was actually a positive trait. Because I think if I had known how difficult or tough of a journey it would have been, I don't think I would have done it. I think in our minds, we believed we were going to build this awesome thing. This was clearly the best way to solve this problem. And then and it was going to be like, make the field and they'll come, right? Kind of thing. And it wasn't that way. We really had to work our asses off. Like most cases, most startups end up being. But yeah, we're really passionate. And to be quite honest, actually, the first thing that we were aiming to solve as a problem didn't end up being the big problem that we solved. We were more attuned to the idea of touring musicians and management companies, that because that was what we knew more intimately. But what we discovered in that world is that they're just so price conscious in there that, you know, when we made that transition over to festivals, because it was like, okay, who do we know that has this problem at a bigger scale where it hurts more and they have bigger budgets? And it was like, okay, let's leave the artist management firms and go to the big festivals, right? And we made that transition. So a lot of tenacity.
You understood the
passion. Need. Yeah. Passion was what got us there. Tenacity was what got us through all of the moments where we could have failed, or, you know, we were failing and we had to correct course.
Yeah. I often think of, if I could have a perfect recipe for startups, it would be like you're saying, you think of a few things and it's naivete, intelligence, passion, and grit, where it's like, you need to be intelligent enough to know whether there's demand, whether there's not, like, it, like, because people that are just passionate and naive, that doesn't make a good entrepreneur at all. In fact, that is the kind of people you don't want to put your money behind because they become delusional. Yeah. And so, but like you said, you understood the space and the product that you were in. You were very intelligent and you could work it. But then also that drive, that just grit will run through walls. So
I think most, like when I look at a lot of the startup founders that I know that have failed, most of them, they just quit.
Yes.
Like, because we failed too. That's the, we failed. Our original thesis, we fail. And we still fail. Yes. And then it's like, you know, I've caught myself. It's funny. It's something I went through in this business when I think I was in like my lowest state. It was like, if I ever do another startup again, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. And then at some point it dawned on me is like, I don't have to wait till I do another startup. I can do this right now with this startup and we can start tomorrow, like a new day, like a new startup. And that's what we're going to do. Right. And I look back at my last startup, like we started off the business of selling software to artist management firms. That value proposition failed. We would not have been able to build the business to get the exit we did on that business. We could have thrown up. We could have thrown the towel. And then instead we went back and we're like, okay, we're not hitting our targets. We're not hitting our goals. The market is not, you know, they're only willing to pay X. That's not going to support it. However, we've tested this other market. We've got three POC customers coming in this summer. This market is this big. Come on, investors, give us another 18 months of runway to prove our POC. We did the POC. We started selling the damn thing. We were able to raise more money. Next thing we signed Coachella. And then, you know, then we started to get this natural influx of customer base throughout US and Europe. And so, you know, we failed. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs and, you know, I think a lot of people go into entrepreneurship with the naivety of thinking this is going to be really good and they're going to become a millionaire. And then they realize this is really hard. And, you know, the hardcore entrepreneurs are the ones that fail and start another startup. The other ones that I know, a lot of people that have started startups, they quit at some point, failed, quit. And they went and get a job.
Yes. They're like, I'm never going that again.
I put my hand in that fire. It hurt. I'm never going back.
Yes. I say this all the time. That people so vastly underestimate what it takes. They so vastly underestimate how bad it will suck. And that is a dangerous thing because you got to be okay with it. So I'm not going to take any of your time. This conversation has been amazing. I mean, the ability to touch on leadership, AI, tech, and then also what makes entrepreneurship work is so vital, just that conversation in general today, where everything's going. But where could people go to find out more about you? Where should we send people?
Yeah, I mean, if you know, I'm on LinkedIn. I'm pretty current. Happy to connect with people there. So it's Darren Gallup. I think I might be the only Darren Gallup on LinkedIn. There might be one other one, but it'd be pretty obvious which one has the music and the cybersecurity background. If you're interested in what I do professionally in terms of my business and my career in cybersecurity, you can go to carbidesecure.com. And if you have any questions there around security or whatever, just happy to connect with folks. So pretty easy person to find. I know of one other Darren Gallup. We're actually friends on Facebook just because we have the same name. I've never met him before. I
love that. That's awesome. Hey, man, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. This was a great conversation. And I know everybody's going to pull a lot from it. So appreciate it.
Thanks. I appreciate it as well.